This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Created equal.
Welcome to Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson. I'm in the studio with Kerry Jr. the second, the show's producer. Hey, Kerry.
How you doing? It's a Friday recap. Oh, wait, I did it wrong again. Dave's going to be mad at us.
Weekly recap.
See, weekly doesn't roll off your tongue the same way.
It doesn't.
It's not as good.
I do like Friday recap, but then they play it again on Saturday. So can't say that.
All right.
So what are we doing this week on the weekly recap? We had some really interesting shows, I think.
Yeah, this past week we had a discussion about how local and state banks can be useful alternatives to national banks. We had a discussion that explores how one woman attempted to quantify white privilege, or a white bonus, as she calls it. And we had a live show where we got updates on Detroit's freeway reconstruction project, that's I-375, the project that tore through Black neighborhoods and businesses, and how their new proposal to remove that freeway and place another road there isn't quite satisfying the residents in that area's wishes.
Yeah. I want to flag the conversation with the author about quantifying white privilege as well. It's an episode that I got some kind of negative feedback about, people not wanting to talk about race in that way, or not believing that it's worth or even possible sort of quantifying something like white privilege. But I would encourage people to listen with an open mind. This is somebody, this author, who really makes an effort to put numbers, something concrete, to something that we talk about all the time, but that is not as definable. So take a listen. Maybe go back and listen to the full episode. I think there's an awful lot in there for people to learn from and to think differently about race in our country.
Let's start right there with the conversation that's making some folks a little uncomfortable. Teresa McMillan is a journalist and author who quantified white privilege, or what she calls white bonus, and then she details it all in her book called The White Bonus. She calculated her and her family's material wealth, jobs, and other opportunities that were available to them that weren't available in the same way to Black folks historically. And she came up with the number $370,000. Let's take a listen.
You talk about a white bonus in the book. We often talk about white privilege. And for a long time, I've wondered about the difficulty that we have getting people to acknowledge this or address it because of that language. And I think for a lot of white people, there is this sense that, hey, if they look around their lives, they don't see things that suggest bonus or privilege, right? And so it's not a matter of looking around your own life and assessing how lucky you were or how fortunate you are. It's that you got things that other people didn't. And that's a harder concept to come to grips with and to understand, even emotionally, right? That even if you are not the most successful person who happens to be white, you are someone who benefited from infrastructure and systems that favor you because of the color of your skin and did not favor others. It's a really tough part of, I think, the conversation that we want to have about this.
Yeah, well, I sort of came through this thinking like, you know, the way that white advantage works is not that you don't have, it's not that you don't have to put in effort. It's not that you don't have to work or be smart or any of that. It's that when you work, it pays off, right? Like that's, you know, I spent time when I was doing my first book working in the fields alongside undocumented immigrants, like picking garlic, right? Mm-hmm. Those people work really, really hard. You know, if hard work was the only thing that translated to wealth, right, those folks would be millionaires, right? And that's not how it works. So it's like a very clear example of, it's not just I worked hard. It's that you are in a position where when you work hard, it generally speaking will pay off. And even if you sort of falter, you're not going to fall too far below, right? Because you have enough of a net to catch you. So I think that's a big part of it. And for me, right, the idea of this white bonus was in some ways trying to stop pretending that white experience is neutral and normal. Like I think in the US, we often talk about, oh, white people are just, we don't even talk about being white. And we say, oh, well, you know, what white people have, that's just what government's supposed to give you. And I think that that's true in the abstract, but in practice, right, we haven't given it to everybody. And in, right, the idea of the white bonus is almost like being like, well, if you were taking the position of sort of like a black person or person of color, if that was the norm, what does white experience look like, right? And it looks like we get a bonus. Like the privilege stuff for me is hard because it's so abstract and easy to shift around. So the idea of a bonus and measurement is just to sort of be like, well, let's get our hands around a number. And then we can talk about how big and why it's there as opposed to whether it exists at all.
So you see the even the use of the word bonus here and the quantification as distinct from the idea of privilege.
It's sort more of a specific. Subset. Yeah. It's kind, I mean, what they're related for sure, but like the idea of a white bonus is to just be like, let's take away your feelings. Let's take away intent. Let's just look at, did you get any money? Probably because you're white, right? Let's just have like a very neutral assessment based on history and statistics and social science about how likely it is you would have had the same experience if you weren't white. And most of the things that I looked into, not everything, but most of the things I looked into, there's always a very clear corollary between advantage and whiteness.
Yeah. So how do you convince other white people to take this seriously, to look at it and say, hold on, okay, I can understand that. This is a number that you're putting on the advantages that I've had, rather than saying, well, how do I know that race accounted for those advantages? How do I know that that this is about institutional racism? I mean, I feel like that's always really difficult when you have these conversations.
Well, I don't know that this book is going to be like an easy sell for everybody, right? For me, it was important to frame it out because it's so often ignored. And it was really transformational for me as somebody who, you know, I've worked since I was 14. I was on my own during college. You know, I've gone through bouts of pretty deep poverty and malnourishment and things like that. So I understand what it's like not to have material resources. And yet when I started looking at what are the things that helped me get through, right, often it was white advantage was opening a door for me, right? So it's that job that I had in college that not only was that particular job, right, but that like that family co-signed for my first apartment in Brooklyn. Wow. So I got an apartment that I probably wouldn't have gotten otherwise. Also was a more likely candidate for that apartment because it was an area for being sort of targeted for gentrification. And as like a white girl who didn't look like anybody in that neighborhood and who, you know, probably would leave within a couple of years, right? Much better for the landlord to bring me in because they could jack up the regulated rent by having somebody who'd flip out really quickly, right? Wow. So all these ways that I did nothing whatsoever to sort of generate those opportunities, they were just given to me largely because of the color of my skin. Not only, right, I had to show up to my job and do a good job with that family. I had to be nice to their kids and all of that stuff. I had to pay my rent. But I was given these opportunities to survive because of advantages that came to me because of whiteness. And for me, that just really shifted my thinking a lot. I don't think every white person is going to come on board with me for this. But I think there are a lot of folks who are trying to understand how to navigate this space and this conversation when you're not somebody who's wealthy.
Yeah.
Right. And when you have really struggled, because we don't have good language for that for white folks. And for me, that I think, you know, in terms of the white readers that I'm sort of targeting, right? It's more those folks, right?
Yeah.
People who are interested and open to this conversation and trying to understand their place.
So what's the role that white people ought to be playing in all of this? Is it, in some cases, to push away the advantages, to say, this is an advantage I'm getting or got or am going to get because of the color of my skin. I'm not going to take it because it adds to the strength of the imbalance that the system has set up. I mean, Is it that explicit that
I'm trying to think if I have done that at all, right? I mean, I think people make their own decisions about that, right? Like, that's a really personal decision. I'm not in a place to be sure. Like, you should, particularly given how competitive our economy is, yes. Right? Because I think one of the things that makes this so difficult is, you know, increasingly you basically have to play the Hunger Games to get into the middle class.
Right.
And so if you're in the Hunger Games, I don't know that I'm going to be like, you should like ditch your advantage and what, like be poor like that. I don't wish that on anybody. Mm-hmm. Right. But for me, you know, one thing I can think of, you know, is I used to serve on the journalism committee for the James Beard Awards mm-hmm. and sort of help administer those prizes. And
for restaurants,
for,
yeah.
For the journalism.
Oh, for
part,
the journalism.
For the journalism
part.
Awards, right? And so, right, that's a coveted position within food media. Sure. It's very good for networking. And as I sort of got through that, you know, I think it's, you can stay on the committee for up to 9 years, right? And I got to like 6 or 7. I was like, you know, I don't feel like I have that much value to add to this. Mm-hmm. This isn't necessary. Somebody who doesn't look like me probably should have this position, right? I will also say that is not my world. That is not sort of the space that I want to occupy. So there's a degree to which, you know, I also wasn't finding deep value in it for myself.
Sure.
Right. But I was like, you know, I don't need the free trips to New York so much. Like I can, can step aside and make space for somebody else here and think about that. Or, right, if you are in a position to help sort of shape things like in a community, on a board, things like that, to make fighting racism and racial equity part of what you're pushing forward in that position. Because one thing I did notice is that as a white woman on that board, the way that we were able to like start tracking demographics of judges and sort of make little shifts towards racial equity was usually if I was the one making the point and then people of color would back me up on it, but weren't leading the charge, right? Mm. Because the thing of like a person of color coming out in an institution and being the voice forward, right? That can make them very vulnerable, right? And so if I'm the one that's sort of the saying it and then I'm getting back up, right? And that's all stuff that happened organically that was not planned.
Yeah.
But I think a lot, you know, about when I'm in a position to push for change, right? Is it more important that I step back or move forward? Huh. And how to do that with intention and consideration and always with the assumption that I am equal with the other people I'm working alongside.
Right.
Because I think that for me is the thing is, because it's not just charity, right? Like fighting racism for me is not charity or altruism. Like, and it's not even just self-interest, which is kind of where this book goes, right? Because I also talk about the ways that racism so eviscerates our safety and impoverishes our democracy that it ends up hurting a lot of white people, right? But it's also liberation, right? Because to feel like I am equal with folks and I'm not trying to navigate constantly about being in a position of superiority or deferring to folks, right, because of the color of their skin, right? But just saying, look, we're equals and we're going to work together. And what can I do that's most effective in this institution, right? Figuring that stuff out.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know that that gets with like, what do I give up?
Yeah. Right? And whether giving up is necessary. I mean, I think there's a kind of logical conclusion from some of the work that you've done here that what we need is for white people to, you know, recalibrate the way in which they engage with the world to be able to shun some of the privilege that they have.
Well, and I think also to move away from this idea, because I see this in my neighborhood in Southwest, like this idea that the only thing that's important is your property values, right? Like folks who have gained equity, particularly as we've seen property values go up, right? To just be like, you know what, maybe we have enough and we don't need to worry about pushing out affordable housing or prioritizing market rate in the neighborhood when there's such need for affordable housing in this city. I mean, if we're all fine, like, and have gained equity, I don't see why we have to keep acting like we need to keep getting more and more and more.
Yeah. I mean, you used a word there that is, I think, real difficult for a lot of us to come to terms with, which is enough. There isn't such a thing in a capitalist society that has sort of run as far into capitalism as we have of enough. It's always more, right? I mean, there's jokes written about what's the answer to the question of when you've had enough? It's like, no, it's always more.
Yeah, and I'm definitely more on the team. I'm team enough. I'm like, as long as I'm stable and I've got like some bit at retirement, like,
yeah,
I feel okay. And I don't need to like profiteer off of stuff constantly or worry about generating more and more and more.
Yeah, yeah. That was Tracy McMillan, journalist and author of The White Bonus. Coming up, we are going to revisit our live show and talk about the efforts nearby residents are taking to re-envision the freeway project that's intended to right historic wrongs against African Americans in Detroit. Stay with us. We'll be right back with more Created Equal.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
It's Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm here with Carrie Jr. II. So up next, we're going to look back at a pretty lively conversation we had with many people, it seemed, about right. the I-375 project and the way it's coming together, and a new group of people who are from the surrounding community who have put together a coalition and are speaking loudly now about their problems with the project and the need to be more attentive to the reparative side of I-375 and to include the community more in the decision.
Yeah, I-375 is a freeway that's just over a mile long on the east side of downtown Detroit. It was built on top of Black businesses and neighborhoods, and it displaced a lot of Black residents. So they recently said they're going to remove that mile and a half or that mile or so long freeway. And the Michigan Department of Transportation is responsible for this project. They recently released a proposal and they've been fielding kind of comments from the community. And the members are not pleased with this initial proposal. They feel like there needs to be a little bit more recognition of that history
right.
to kind of how are we going to, in some ways, repair the historical wrongs that were done by the freeway initially. With the project that they're doing presently.
And so we talked with two members of this Rethink the I-375 Project Coalition, mm-hmm. Carl Bentley and Olga Stella. They both live in neighborhoods nearby I-375. And we also had Malachi Barrett, who mm-hmm. is a reporter at Bridge Detroit. He covers city government and has been writing about I-375. Mm-hmm. The three of them really rounded out, I think, the perspectives that you want to hear about what's going on. I want to start this segment talking about something that I learned about not too long ago when I visited Minneapolis, Minnesota. The city of St. Paul is also thinking about reparations and how to fix the damage that was done by the construction of a highway. And that's been a pretty controversial project in that city. But they also have come up with some really interesting ideas that, I don't know, seem like they might apply here in Detroit. There is a program called the Inheritance Fund in St. Paul. This is a fund that is available to people whose families lived in the neighborhood that was destroyed by the highway. They can get down payment assistance. They can have access to a homeowner rehab program. They're handing out as much as $100,000 per family to wow. buy homes, either in this area or in other areas. In other words, they're starting with the idea of reparation before they get to the idea of what the highway should look like or what the streets should look like. Ironically, the highway they're talking about there in Minnesota is a highway we have here in the city of Detroit as well, I-94, which goes west from here to Minneapolis. But it was just a reminder for me of how troubling and how frustrating the process here has been the whole time. These are not things that anybody has really suggested who's part of the process or the decision-making process here. And yet in Minneapolis, they're much further ahead than we are. It seems often in Detroit, if you look to other communities, they're doing it in a way that that makes us envious and somewhat sorrowful, I think. Malachi, when you talk to city and state officials, do they ever even reference this kind of idea or program?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of this is it kind of started the concept of a boulevard, from my understanding, started with a planning grant that Kresge had gave to DEGC to study the boulevard idea. And so there were kind of talks around 2014 about how removing the freeway and turning it into a boulevard could kind of reconnect parts of downtown to those Lower East Side neighborhoods. And, you know, the federal government came in, I guess it would have been like 2 years ago now, with some grant money that is part of a national effort to reconnect communities that have been divided by highways. And so that piece of it has really kind of emerged throughout the process. But I don't know. I mean, the federal kind of Thriving Communities grant was an opportunity to add that element, I think, to this design that maybe initially, I don't know. I think that's a complicated thing. I mean, we're seeing it in motion still, right?
Yeah, we are. I'm not sure where we end up, and I'm not sure at what point the thing turns toward this kind of reparative discussion.
I don't think I've heard as part of any of these conversations what you had mentioned about the access to financing and land that has been going on in other parts of the country with these federally backed projects.
Mm-hmm.
I think if that was brought into the conversation, it might provide more of a, you know, concrete example for things that people are looking for when it comes to the land use.
Yeah.
But from my understanding, I don't really think that's been part of the conversation so far.
I've looked at the environmental assessment closely, the one that was conducted and approved in 2021 by the Federal Highway Administration. And all of the restorative justice, anything that relates to Black Bottom, anything that relates to community enhancements, all of the kind of community benefits that are supposed to come out of this to mitigate the potential impacts are all supposed to be funded by the sale of the land.
Mm.
Yet that we don't know how the land is supposed to be sold. MDOT is still trying to figure that out. And when will this land be sold?
Yeah.
I think we all are conversant in Detroit development. There is a lot of vacant land near downtown that has not yet been developed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to ask the residents, the small business owners, and anyone who is impacted by the highway removal, you know, when it happened, to wait for the land to be sold and then for that to fund community benefits, and that is just completely unrealistic.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I think Carl and I are not experts in restorative justice.
We're not
traffic engineers. We have been talking with our neighbors and with others who are concerned. And what we are asking for is for MDOT, for our elected leaders to take a moment, really think about the impact of this project and to reform this process that they're using.
Yeah.
Because we're not pretending like we know exactly how to fix, you know, this freeway design. That is beyond the capacity of any individual resident or business owner.
Yeah, go ahead, Carl.
And you know, I just think that they're looking at this from repairing a wrongdoing of, you know, how they built the road to begin with, all right? So they're overlooking the fact that when they did that, they ripped up families, okay, and, you know, took away, you know, a thriving area, and we get a, you know, a freeway out of it. which I think they need to go back, and that's why we say rethink, okay? It's not a road project. This is a neighborhood transformational project. So let's look at it from that perspective, all right? And then the road becomes a byproduct of it as opposed to, you know, the what we keep hearing, it's a road project. No, this is a transformative neighborhood project, okay, that we really need to step back and take a look at it from that lens and not look at it from the road project perspective.
Yeah. I want to read a social media comment from James, who says, a cement monument can't replace reparations now owed. He says, solicit residents who were uprooted. My first house was on Maple and Shane, 1951. We're still around. As I said, you can't be in Detroit very long without running into people who lived in this area and were affected by all the things that happened. Let's go to the phones and start today with Jacqueline in Detroit. Jacqueline, welcome to the show.
Good morning. I want to comment on, first of all, I called into the Mitch Albom show one time. Mike Duggan was on there, and he had mentioned that that the neighborhood surrounding this project, that through town hall meetings, had really gave overwhelming approval of this project. And also, when I was talking to the young man, I let him know, and the guy mentioned that during that time, we as a family, I mean, my cousins, my aunt, two aunts and cousins, you know, we all lived together, and we all, you know, it's just my parents was in Black Bottom first. Then they moved down to Hendry and Hastings. Mm-hmm. You know, they were displaced there. Then I-75 came along with I-94, and we were displaced again where we had to move again. I think I was about 4 years old then, but I'm 70 now. But, you know, I just don't like that the mayor is saying one thing, and, you know, and then he strictly says that this is reparations, you know, when he first came out with it. But from what I'm hearing on the radio, there is, you know, it's not even in the paperwork.
Yeah. Jacqueline, I'm glad you called principally because, you know, you're somebody else who lived in this area and remembers it and remembers what happened. I think those voices are really critical right now because they tell us the truth about what happened, and it's, you know, it's important that that doesn't get erased in what we're talking about. But I also am curious about this thing that you heard from the mayor about people being in favor of this, Olga and Carl, at the town halls that were held, which they were. I mean, MDOT has held meetings for people to talk. What has been the tenor of what people have said?
So I think it's important to for everyone to understand exactly what kinds of public engagement have taken place. There were town halls in 2017. I honestly don't remember those town halls. Those were about the boulevard. Mm-hmm. So the project at that time was from Gratiot to the river, and it was just the boulevard. The interchange was not affected. In 2018 and 2019, MDOT held meetings with its local advisory council at that time. Carl and I were not members of that local advisory council. Nope. We were not involved. There may have been, we've heard that there were other community meetings, neighborhood meetings. There's nothing in the public record about public town halls, those kinds of meetings. If people in our community were invited, you know, that's great, but that does not, that kind of engagement in small groups does not replace widespread engagement.
Yeah.
In 2019, they added in the interchange project sometime in 2018, 2019. Those were shared with the local advisory council that time. The first time that was shared publicly in a widespread way was when they were coming for public comment in 2021. In January of 21, during the pandemic, in a city where we were teaching our children from home and people were struggling for their lives.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's hard, you know, I'm sure some people were engaged, but when we talk to our neighbors, when we show up to the public engagement that's happening now, people are either shocked and confused that the project is taking place, or have serious concerns. And the kinds of concerns that we're hearing from our neighbors and small businesses are about pedestrian safety, about public safety, access to the Detroit Medical Center, which will be severely impacted by the design of this project. What's going to happen to this land? Tell us more about what this reconnecting communities project means. You know, those are the, you know, how will my small business be affected? Those are the concerns that we continue to hear. So it very well may be that this engagement took place,
right,
but the concerns were not addressed.
Right. Yeah. And that's one of the things that, you know, I've pointed out several times, I think, to the officials, is that you collect this data, you hear these comments, you hear these questions, and you get no answers. I mean, there's nothing that's been distilled to say that, you know, public safety will be addressed this way,
mm-hmm.
right? We were on a call a couple weeks ago, and one of the officials said that, well, you know, no one walks from this area to Easton Market. And that was, I was floored by that comment. That just tells me this person's never even been in the area to understand that, you know, the majority of the people will take that walk, you know.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it's just things like that, that the information is certainly, those forums probably occurred, information was taken, and then it was put on a shelf somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, Jacqueline, really appreciate your call and that important info about your history here in the city. Let's go next to Peter in Detroit. Peter, what's on your mind?
Good morning. Hey, love the new show, and especially that new Sam Bobian theme song.
Love you it. Like the music?
oh, yeah. Stephen, here's what my concern is. Is number one, I think they're rushing it. And right. the other thing is that they're being so uncreative. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you're going to do a big project, look to where things like this have been done other places. Mm. And learn from other people's mistakes and learn from successes. In Washington, D.C., and in a lot of other cities, there is a highway that runs right underneath the mall
mm-hmm.
because they weren't going to plow through the mall. They let the mall up there, they tunneled under. Well, 375 is already in a big ditch. Why not build over the top of that and put a community and stores and everything else over the top of that? You still keep 375. The concerns for how are people going to get downtown, that's gone. And you can build a community up there that is what people want.
Yeah.
That is what, you know, engage them and find out what is it that we want to do. But you can have both things if you're creative enough.
Yeah, Peter, I love that you called and suggested that, because I, you know, one of my questions from the beginning is why would you want to get rid of the freeway and replace it with a road that acts like a freeway?
Right.
What's the difference? You know, and also if you put 6 or 9 lanes at grade instead of sunken, now you're asking people to cross that if they want to get from the neighborhoods on the east side into downtown. I don't walk across Woodward in
That's
most
right.
places because it's too wide. I don't walk across Gratiot, even at a light, because it's too wide and
right.
it seems dangerous. You would create that same phenomenon there. And so why not think about getting rid of the freeway and creating a community with,
right.
I don't know, 1 or 2 lane streets mm-hmm. and housing and shopping and all those things. And that was never seemed to be on the boards here. It never seemed to be part of what
right.
they were considering. And I love the idea of tunneling as well, right? The Big Dig in Boston is an example of that, mm-hmm. although that was a kind of fraught project. Maybe we don't want to idolize that one too much, but the idea is what's important. That was our conversation about I-375 and the project to rethink it. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll hear a conversation about the idea of state banks and what they can do to support better local lending in cities like Detroit. Stay where you are. We'll be right back with more Created Equal.
Welcome back to Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson, joined by Carrie Jr. II in studio, and you are listening to our weekly recap.
So it doesn't
need that theme music.
It doesn't hit the same.
It doesn't hit the same as Friday.
No, it doesn't.
We can't make that work.
So
now we're going to turn to a conversation I had earlier this week about local and state-owned banking. This idea that if you're a low-income person living in a city like Detroit, that it's harder to find access to banking than it is in other places. It's harder to get a branch open near you, and it's way harder to get a loan out of banks, national banks, that have gobbled up so many of the local banks. And this idea of a state-owned bank, which North Dakota is really the only state in America that has one, that makes it easier, that it can provide support for community and local banks that are better at that kind of lending than the national banks are.
That's right. Oscar Periabello is a senior economic justice correspondent for the urban magazine Next City. He joined us to talk about his reporting and writing. So he's written about how local banks aren't as prevalent as they once were. And his reporting has shown that there's more need for banking services nowadays on a smaller scale. So there's this gap between what people on a local level need and what national banks can provide. And he believes that local and state banks can fill that gap.
Yeah. And it's an important gap to fill. If you have spent any time in the city of Detroit in neighborhoods that are hard hit by, you know, financial problems, banking is one of the real aggravating issues. Access to banking, access to loans. And so Oscar Abello says, look, why not think about something like a state bank? Oscar, I want to start this segment talking about this idea of a state bank. I think when you say that term to most people, they have no idea what you're talking about. They've never heard of it. We do, however, have a citizen here in Detroit who is a listener to this show, who whenever we talk about anything in terms of financial institutions or financial access, he gives us a call and lets us know about the idea of a state bank. He's a really big fan of the idea. His name is Chris. I hope he is listening as we have this conversation. But I want to have you talk about the one state in the union that actually is trying this and has been trying this for some time, and I guess how it works, how it affects this lack of access that we see in places like Detroit or Michigan or other states in the union.
Sure, Stephen, great to be with you. Thanks again for having me on. So the funny thing about North Dakota, where you have the one state-owned bank that's been in operation for 100 years. The funny thing about it is most people in North Dakota either haven't heard of it, or if they have heard of it, they don't necessarily realize it's a state-owned bank.
They don't even know.
That's because of the way. They don't even know. They may not even know that it helped them unless they ask about it. Mm-hmm. I'll give you an example. When I went to Fargo in December of 2019, it was winter, it was snowing, it was very cold. I think the high temperature was -7 degrees. But I went to an international grocery store, FM International Grocery Store, owned by two immigrant gentlemen in Fargo. And I had heard from another immigrant entrepreneurship group in the Fargo area that they had helped these guys set up, get their grocery store started, and then eventually to buy the building where the grocery store is located. And I was like, that's amazing. How did they buy the building? Oh, they got a loan from Cornerstone Bank. So we helped them get the loan. Cornerstone Banks is a community bank based in Fargo. Mm-hmm. And so, I went to the grocery store, talked to them. They were like, yeah, Cornerstone, it was great. It was nice working with the immigrant entrepreneurship group. We got the small business loan for $250,000. And we bought the building and all the equipment too. It was a pre-existing grocery store, so it had all the freezers and refrigeration and all the equipment inside. They bought all of it, and they were paying less on the mortgage than they were paying in rent before. Okay, so great. So I went to Cornerstone Banks, I went to the community bank, and I said, "Hey, you make small business loans a lot in the Fargo area and across the states. tell me, like, do you know, can you tell me if the Bank of North Dakota helped you finance this small business loan to this particular borrower? And they went through their paperwork and they looked it up in their records and they found out, yeah, actually, the Bank of North Dakota helped us finance this small business loan to this borrower. And the borrower didn't know, and most small businesses don't know that the banks that they get small business loans from in North Dakota are almost always getting help from the state-owned bank in North Dakota to finance those loans.
Yeah. So let's talk about how that works. What is it that the state bank is doing to get these smaller banks the cash to be able to finance these smaller loans for people in the state?
Yeah. So the main structure that the Bank of North Dakota uses is called a loan participation. And private banks do this with each other more than you would realize. In a loan participation, basically, there's one bank that knows the business. It might be a community bank. It might even be a larger bank. But, you know, the business, let's say it requests $1 million loan. And the bank says, well, we can only, because of our constraints, we can only loan you $500,000. In a loan participation, they can bring in another lender behind the scenes. It could be a private lender to provide the other $500,000 that the borrower needs to buy a building or put some solar panels on top of their building or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And they get $1 million. And the borrower never realizes behind the scenes that there's more than one lender on this loan, because they're only dealing with the one bank that's local to them, mm-hmm. the one bank that they know. But that bank is bringing in capital from somewhere else. In North Dakota, you have the Bank of North Dakota that can do that. I mean, in other states, like you mentioned, this happens in other states, in other markets, more frequently than you would realize. But it can be challenging. You know, I've talked with small credit unions in Brooklyn, New York, where there's so many financial institutions here. Mm-hmm. But the small credit union needed to do a $3 million loan. It had to call around four other credit unions before it could get two of them to help it cover what the borrower needed. Mm. This is in New York City. So think about it, in North Dakota, if you didn't have the Bank of North Dakota around to call up and say, look, I need a loan participation, can you help me out? Because basically that's the Bank of North Dakota's main line of business. It's loan participations. You know, it's got hundreds of loans on its books. It does about 500 commercial loans every year. And those loans are all loan participations.
Yeah.
Basically, a local bank has to approve the loan first, and then the Bank of North Dakota comes in behind the scenes to help it out. So.
Yeah. And the money that the state bank has comes from the state itself. Like, the idea here is that the state is making a public investment, I guess, would be the way to describe it, in this kind of accessibility, to loans, to capital.
Exactly. I mean, that was the idea way back in 1919, you know, now more than 100 years ago, when basically the farmers in North Dakota were really upset with the big banks in Minneapolis and Chicago that weren't really able to give them loans on terms that they could afford. So they realized, well, we all pay taxes to our state government, and those taxes get deposited into a bank. What bank is it? Mm-hmm. And they said, well, whatever bank it is, we're going to create our own state-owned bank, deposit our tax dollars there, and that bank will then be able to make loans or work with the private sector, private lenders across North Dakota, to help those local lenders make loans on terms we can afford as farmers all across the state. Mm. And that was the idea back in 1919, and it's pretty much still what happens today. I mean, it's not all farmers anymore. North Dakota's, you know, got shale oil and all kinds of other industries popping up, and it's not just farming, but it is still a lot of farming that happens in North Dakota, and that's a big part of the Bank of North Dakota's business.
Yeah. So it seems to me that there are a couple of instances where this would pay really big dividends. I mean, it of course sounds like a better system to make sure that capital is available to, you know, small borrowers, small commercial borrowers, those kind of things. But the two instances I'm thinking of, I'll start with the first, is in the case of financial emergency. So let's go back, for instance, to the Great Crash. Now about 15, 16 years ago, and the availability of capital was really in jeopardy in most places. It seems to me that if you've got a state bank and it's those state assets that power the financial lending in the state, maybe it's not as dire. The crisis is not as dire as it would be in another state. Is that what happened in North Dakota during the Great Crash?
Yes, but with the confounding variable that right around the time the crash happens, mm-hmm. the shale oil industry also picked up in North Dakota.
Okay.
And that sort of became, so it's, you know, it would take economists some time to research and figure out to really know what was more of a driving factor. They could have been equally driving factors, but ultimately, yes, in North Dakota, there was no Great Recession, so to speak, the way there was in the rest of the country. In part because you have a stronger local banking system that's kind of able to pick up the pieces.
Yes.
But that reason that it's a stronger local banking system is because you have a state-owned bank that's entirely designed to support a local banking system.
Yeah, it's backing them up.
Yeah, and even with the shale oil industry, one of the reasons that industry was able to scale up so quickly is because the state-owned bank in North Dakota was able to work with the local private lenders to scale it up. You know, it's not just the industry that needs loans, right? For all the workers that got pulled into those jobs mm-hmm. in Western North Dakota, someone had to build the housing. Someone had to finance the construction of all that housing. Someone had to finance the home loans to the workers to move into those to those housing units. And guess what? When the rest of the country's housing market was collapsing because right. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and everybody else kind of collapsed in North Dakota, because you have this stabilizing force of the state-owned bank, it was able to roll right into like, oh no, we can build all the little things you need around where the shale oil is. Mm. You can build it now. I may not like fossil fuels. I may not like
right. That's another oil. Issue.
that's another issue. But it is part of the story of how their North Dakota was able to avoid a recession during the financial crisis. Yeah. Not only the oil industry growing up there, but like, yeah, the state-owned bank and the local banks being able to pivot into doing all the things you need to scale up an industry pretty quickly.
That was Oscar Perry Abello, a reporter with Next City, talking with me about the idea of state banking and how it could help with local lending in communities like Detroit. Really interesting conversation with Oscar, who's been researching and writing about this issue for a long time. He's working on a book about it. We'll have him back, I'm sure, when that book is out. But in general, another kind of strong and diverse week of topics that we tackled here, Carrie.
Yeah, I think for Oscar, the point he made about the shale oil industry and how local banks supported that, which provided an economy that seems like, according to him, withstood the recession, the 2008 recession in that state in North Dakota. And then there was the point that Tracy McMillan made that the way you frame white privilege is that when you work hard, that hard work pays off more often than other communities because they have other obstacles. So those were some really strong, I think, points that we hit on throughout this week.
Yeah. So that'll do it for us this week on Created Equal. Remember, you can listen to recent episodes of our show at WDET.org, and we would love if you would subscribe to our podcast, where you can leave us a rating or a review. Created Equal is produced by Carrie Jr. II and David Lines. The audio editing is by Connor Anderson, and the music is from Sam Bobian. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.